Where do I begin on Newt? He was smart. He was fast on his feet, a sharp-elbowed campaigner. He was a historian by training and first been elected to Congress in 1978, so he'd been around a while and seen a lot. He also had that air of destiny about him, like he felt he was meant for great things. Someone stepped in his path toward greatness. Well, that was their problem. In late 1993, I started meeting every once in a while with Newt and a small group of members to discuss how we might make him the next leader. There aren't many secrets in Washington, and naturally, Bob Michael was aware of Gingrich's ambitions. Newt also wasn't exactly known for playing it cool. As a result, there was tension between the two camps, for sure. But having a good relationship with both men, I tried to keep things from getting too heated. As it turned out, though, there was no need for a leadership struggle. In early 1994, Bob Michael announced he was going to retire at the age of 71, which still made him something of a spring chicken among the old birds of the House. He wasn't a dummy. He knew he could either leave through the door or get tossed out of a window. We quickly rallied around Newt as his successor, but we knew that in order to make that happen, we had to do a better job of engaging all Republican members in a way that had never been done before. People like being brought in. They like to feel like they have skin in the game. For all of Newt's other skills, this was one of his biggest tests. The annual Republican members' retreat was coming up when all of us would pack into buses like kids going off to summer camp and head off to some hotel in the D.C. area for a weekend of presentations. Mostly, we were talked at by leadership, pollsters, and so on. I decided, along with a couple of other Conservative Opportunity Society guys, that instead of just being talked at, we should talk to the members. It should be a conversation among the whole family, not just a bunch of kids sitting there while the adults in leadership lectured them. Nobody likes being lectured. Well, it turned out to be maybe the best retreat we'd ever had. Suddenly, members were actually talking to one another, trying to understand one another, working to get to a position where we knew who we were and what we were there to do. And we decided that we, after all these years, were finally going to bring back a Republican majority to the House. At that retreat, pushed on by this newfound energy, we began to hatch the plan. Bill Clinton's first term had not been going well. I couldn't figure out how he blundered so badly since his skillful campaign of 1992, where he managed to survive accusations of adultery, draft dodging, being a communist, drug running, and even mass murder. Some of those allegations were more credible than others, but I'll let you decide which is which. Baba had run for president as the new kind of Democrat, a Southern moderate, and yet the very first things he did were to pursue liberal social policies that many in the country just weren't ready for. A total takeover of our healthcare system, for one, allowing gays to serve openly in the military, for another, earned him a rebuke from national hero Colin Powell. It was around this time that I first met a Southern Democrat senator named Hal Heflin. Heflin was an old-school deal-making Pole. He was a former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court and a beloved figure in the state. There's no way he could be a Democrat if he ran for office today. He thought the Clinton crowd was a bunch of radical hippies who were taking over his party. Gays in the military as an issue, well, it just wasn't his thing. So I'll never forget our first meeting. I was at a D.C. restaurant, sitting with a group of other legislators, having a good time. Suddenly, I felt a tap on my shoulder. I turned around to see a very round, older man with slick back hair. It was Senator Heflin. Seeing me hold a camel in my hand, he said with a thick Alabama drawl, "I'm glad to see you smoking that cigarette." He told me he had just gone to the White House that day, his first visit since the Clintons were elected. It was not a kumbaya moment. "I lit up my cigarette like I always did," the senator told me, his eyes flickering with annoyance. "And these kids come running over saying, 'Oh, Senator, Senator, you can't smoke here.' I looked back at them and I said, 'I can't smoke here, but it would be okay if I put a penis in my mouth.'" Anyway, that was the cultural blowback Clinton was dealing with. His approval ratings were low and getting lower. The American people were souring on the Clinton charm, although I'm not sure how much charm there really was. I always thought he reminded me of Eddie Haskell, the kiss-up kid from the old TV show Leave It to Beaver. But we couldn't just run against the president. We had to offer an alternative, something to get voters in congressional districts all over the country to take a serious look at Republican candidates. It was Newt who came up with the idea of the contract with America. Sometimes Newt would go into eccentric professor mode and come up with pie-in-the-sky ideas without much follow-through. And at first we thought that might be what was happening here. But the more we looked at it, the more the idea gained momentum. And before we knew it, it had focused on 10 key issues and even written legislation we promised to enact to advance the agenda. We raised the money to unveil this to the American people with a one-page ad in Reader's Digest, which at the time was one of the most widely read monthly publications in the country. In the run-up to the election, we held an event where everybody signed the contract publicly. I don't know if the contract with America got us the majority. Newt, of course, believed that it did. Personally, I think Bill Clinton got us the majority. But the contract certainly helped, and it gave all of us Republicans something to organize ourselves around. And in that regard, it soon became clear that we needed all the help we could get. We were about to get a crash course in the very distinct differences between politics and governing. That's a lesson a lot of people in Congress and the White House these days have never learned. Election night 1994 was a thrilling moment. All our hard work had paid off, and Republicans had taken back the House after all those years. But after we got the celebratory shit out of the way, we realized we had no clue how to run the place. None. Nobody in the entire Republican Congress had ever served in the majority in the House. Not one. There was no institutional memory, and we had to figure it all out as we went along. We were given lists of offices to assign in the Capitol and had no idea who was currently in them. We didn't even know where some of them were. As a majority party, we were now responsible for the Capitol and coordinating all the permanent non-political staff who made the building run. The engineers, the electricians, the carpenters, and so on. We had to schedule a special tour with the architect of the Capitol so he could show some of us around and point out areas of the old building we didn't even know existed. Eventually, despite the fits and starts, we did take over. And 1995 began with Newt becoming the 50th Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives. He was an instant superstar. On the cover of Time magazine, his news conferences carried live, recognized everywhere. The huge boost of oxygen would take a toll on even the most modest of men. And then there was Newt Gingrich. As I say, Newt was one of the brightest people I've ever met, and I liked him, and still do. I credit him with a lot, but like any of us, he had his flaws. As I said, sometimes the eccentric professor side of him came out. He had 100 ideas an hour, and maybe 90 of them made sense. Those last 10, though, well, they could be trouble. Oh, how he loved to strategize. Unfortunately, we never had time to implement last week's strategic plan before he came up with a new one. Newt used to advertise his management philosophy on a sign mounted in his office, which read, "Listen, learn, help, and lead." Occasionally, he'd even do some of these things. At one point, some of us on his leadership team turned the sign upside down so the instructions were in reverse order, which reflected the reality. I guess he didn't think it was too funny because when we came in for the next meeting, the sign had been moved up higher on the wall, out of reach. Whichever way the sign was facing, Newt had to manage more than 200 members, all jockeying for position in the new majority. He didn't always have time or patience for all of that. If two members came up to Newt with conflicting requests, his instincts would be to say yes to both of them, just so he could get them out of his hair and move on to his next big idea he was interested in. And while Newt was off on his vision quest, it was up to the rest of us and the leadership team to clean up the mess. This is where I came in. When Newt became Speaker, I became the chairman of the House Republican Conference, the fourth ranking position on the House leadership ladder. The body of all Republicans in the House taken together is known as the Republican Conference. The Democrats call themselves a caucus because, of course, we can't do it the same way. The job of the conference chair is to keep 200 or so rank-and-file Republican members on the same page as the top three in the leadership, the majority whip, the majority leader, and the speaker, to make sure everyone sticks to the same unified message. It might seem strange for a guy to spend his first couple of years throwing bombs from the floor often toward his own side of the aisle, only to end up as part of the leadership. Gingrich knew what he was doing by bringing one of the rabble-rousers of the Gang of Seven into the leadership team. Besides, I had my eye on leadership from the beginning. At the very end of 1990, after I'd been elected but before I got sworn in, I sat down with Barry Jackson and a few other friends, soon to be staffers, and we had a simple conversation. They asked me, well, what kind of member do you want to be? We talked through different types. For some members, it was all about the district, so they stayed focused on local issues. Some got really into their committee work and became experts on the particular policy area they worked on. But then there was the leadership track, helping craft the agenda, keeping the team together to get things done. Well, I didn't have to think about it for very long. I was going to be a leadership guy, and that was that. From there, it was pretty easy to figure out the end goal. If I didn't want to end up at the top of the leadership ladder as speaker, what was the point of climbing on in the first place? So while I spent a fair amount of time causing trouble with the Gang of Seven, I also made a point to do everything I could for my fellow members to help them raise money. And yeah, money talks. People liked that I was willing to show up for a golf outing or a dinner or a reception and give a little speech about how great a guy the candidate was. It was not like they had to twist my arm either. I was having a pretty good time. When we took back the majority in 1994, I knew it was time to make a move. No, I hadn't been there very long, and yes, I'd ruffled some feathers, but I worked my ass off to help us take back the house, and I was damn sure going to help us run the show. Naturally, I wasn't the only one with that idea. Before we even left to campaign for the final leg of the 1994 election, there have been discussions amongst the Republican members over how to proceed if we won the majority. Members were already angling for committee and leadership spots. The top contender for conference chair looked to be Representative Bob Livingston. Livingston was a Southern gentleman from Louisiana who'd been in Congress since 1977. Bob was, in many ways, the natural choice, and I'm sure he'd made a fine chairman, but I had other ideas. After the election, with the majority official, I still hadn't declared myself in the leadership race. But I had been helping our transition team talk through committee assignments, which gave me an idea. And I picked up the phone and called Bob Livingston. Bob, I asked, wouldn't you rather be chairman of the Appropriations Committee? The Appropriations Committee held the purse strings for the entire government. Since all federal funding bills had to originate in the House, his chairman was one of the most powerful committee posts on the Hill. Even the subcommittee chairs, not usually the most glamorous titles, were unofficially called cardinals. Well, Bob didn't waste any time in responding, yeah. I'll tell you what, I offered. You get out of this conference race, and I'll do everything I can to help you. Sure enough, Bob called Gingrich to let him know he was no longer interested in the conference spot. Of course, I had tipped off Gingrich, and he went along with my plan. When the new Congress was sworn in January, Bob Livingston took up the gavel as Appropriations Committee chairman. One down. I was officially in the race by this time, and the only other formidable contender was Duncan Hunter, Sr. of California. My member friends, my staff, and I started working the phones hard, talking members' ears off and twisting their arms to try to get their support. We knew Hunter and his buddies were doing the same thing, too. Until one day they weren't. In the middle of the leadership race, Hunter had somehow just disappeared for a couple of days. He dropped off the map. Finally, we figured out what had happened. He had a late fall hunting trip scheduled for after the election, but before Christmas. He'd been looking forward to it and wasn't going to let a leadership election spoil it for him. So he disappeared off into the woods over a long weekend, mostly cut off from the world. This was before our cell phones were genetically attached. That gave me all the time I needed. By the time Hunter resurfaced the following Monday, I had already lined up enough votes to become the new conference chair. When the new majority took over in January 1995, the leadership team was Speaker Gingrich, Majority Leader Dick Armey, Majority Whip Tom DeLay, both Texans, and me. I knew that personalities were key to the leadership staff of any organization. They can take on an outsized influence when politicians are involved. Armey and I got along great. My staff got along great with his staff, which is key to making any leadership operation run smoothly. The staff have to be able to all work with one another. Delay and his people, on the other hand, always seemed to be marching to their own beat. Delay had a strong personality and seemed to run his office like a dictatorship. His staff were either loyal or scared or both, and they shut out everybody else. The staff problems got so bad that it seemed like his staff were carrying out vendettas against other leadership staffers. There were thorns in everyone's side. And my personal relationship with Delay wasn't much better either. I remember from some of the earliest meetings I attended as a new member, he looked at me funny. Maybe he saw a threat. It's hard to say. As it turned out, it wasn't just me. Our first member retreat in the majority army and I found ourselves with adjoining rooms. I ran into him in the hallway and asked if I could talk to him in private. He came into my room, shut the door, shoved the rug up against the crack at the bottom of the door. He was not playing around. "What's up?" he asked. I said, "Help me understand Tom Delay. Dick's been around longer than I had. I figured he might have some insight." "You think I can help you understand him?" Dick came back. "He doesn't like me at all." "Well, he doesn't like me either," I responded. And neither of us left that day with any better understanding of how Delay's mind worked or didn't, as the case might be. He never got any easier to understand or work with during the rest of the time we served in leadership together. It was from Delay's unique brand of political calculation that the idea came to campaign on a promise to impeach Bill Clinton in a run-up to the 1998 midterms. For those who don't remember what the Clinton case involved, here's a brief primer. Everybody with eyes and or ears knew about Bill Clinton's reputation with women. When he got himself involved with a 22-year-old intern, Monica Lewinsky, and then appeared to lie about it and encourage others to lie, many people around town assumed he was done. I thought he'd die from embarrassment or maybe at the hands of his wife. Whether what he did as president was a high crime or misdemeanor requiring some impeachment was another story. I've lived through three presidential impeachment inquiries, Nixon's, Clinton's, and Trump's. But there was only one, Bill Clinton's, where I was a participant as a member of the House leadership. I know what we all said at the time. Bill Clinton was impeached for lying under oath. In my view, Republicans impeached him for one reason and one reason only, because it was strenuously recommended to us by one, Tom Delay. Tom believed that impeaching Clinton would win us all these House seats, would be a big win politically, and he convinced enough of the membership and the GOP base that this was true. I was on board at the time. I won't hide from that. I won't pretend otherwise. But I regret it now, and I regret that I didn't fight against it. Impeachment of the president is meant to be a tool of last resort. Nancy Pelosi had it right, or at least she did at first, when she contemplated impeaching Donald Trump. It has to be bipartisan. Not everyone in both parties has to be on board, but at least a good number do. A partisan impeachment simply does not have credibility to most Americans. That's exactly what we pursued against Clinton. Clinton probably did commit perjury. That's not a good thing. But lying about an affair to save yourself from embarrassment isn't the same as lying about an issue of national security. Delay, however, was absolutely convinced that this was the right thing to do, and for the next 6 weeks leading up to the election, all we talked about was impeachment. Instead of gaining 5 seats like we expected, we lost 5 seats. Even though Delay had been the one beating the impeachment horse hardest, the responsibility lay at the top. Even putting aside impeachment, Newt had become a real problem for the Republican majority. His management issues hadn't improved. Meanwhile, I was dealing with management issues of my own. By this time, my two daughters, Lindsay and Tricia, had grown from two of the cutest little girls you ever hoped to see into, well, teenagers. They were still cute. I still loved them to death. But two teenage girls, close in age, stuck at home with their outnumbered mother while I was spending half my time in Washington, it was a recipe for disaster. Deb was holding the fort, but I was always ready to help. There was no way those girls were going to get away with more just because their dad was away for work. There were plenty of times when I'd be sitting at my desk, on the phone, on one line with some member, trying to defuse a crisis in the House Republican ranks, while on another line, I'd have Deb telling me what trouble the girls were giving her, and then Lindsay and Tricia themselves on a third line giving me their side of the story, and everybody trying to talk at once. It was around that time I gave the girls nicknames, Bad and Worse. And Lindsay was usually worse. Sorry, honey. So you can forgive me for getting tired of Newt's absent-minded professor shtick after a while. And it wasn't wearing thin just for me. It sometimes got in the way of his getting along with his members. Because he was so busy thinking, he'd end up making snap decisions and then moving on. Or he'd get so wrapped up in thought while walking the halls of the Capitol, or the tunnels underneath, or on the sidewalk above, that he wouldn't pay attention to his colleagues walking past. He wouldn't even acknowledge them, let alone stop and say hi. Sometimes it felt like he was the star of some big college faculty, and those of us in the rank and file were jockeying for time during his office hours. Even when I was a pretty new arrival myself, I wasn't shy about giving him advice. Newt, I'd remind him, respectfully, of course, when you pass one of your members in the hall, stop and say hello. These are the people who can vote for you or vote against you. And he'd always promise to be better about it. Sometimes he was, but usually he'd go back to doing the things his own way. He had let his press attention get to his head, and the press loved to feed on their own creations. There was a sense that he was getting rolled by the Clinton White House, like, every day. He was often disheveled. Back in the 90s, he wore some of the worst neckties I've ever seen. I remember telling him early on, Newt, you've got to buy some new ties. Those are just awful. One time in early 1996, Newt hustled back from a meeting at the White House, and the first thing out of his mouth to all of us waiting anxiously for his report was, Clinton really liked my tie. We all rolled our eyes. And you probably believed him, I said. This was the same old Eddie Haskell-like Clinton charm. He could steal your watch right in front of you, and you'd be grateful when he told you the time. Clinton had been on the ropes when Republicans took power, but he was a survivor. He masterfully used Newt's weaknesses against him. It was my job to break the news to Gingrich that it was time for him to step down as Speaker. The day after the election, he called me. What do you think, he said. Newt, you're not going to want to hear this, I told him, but I think you've led the team as far as you can lead them. It was clear that was not the answer he was expecting. As your friend, I told him, I just don't think you'll have the votes come January to be elected Speaker. He thanked me, got off the line. The next day he called me again. Well, what do you think, he asked. Well, the same thing I thought yesterday. What did I tell you about his listening skills? That time he got the message, and by the next day he had announced his intention to resign. But Newt wasn't the only casualty of the 1998 midterm losses. In late 1998, a member from Oklahoma, J.C. Watts, announced he was going to run to replace me as conference chair. Watts was a charismatic former college football star who'd been elected in the class that helped us take back the House in 1994. I respected the challenge, but I expected to hold on. This was until I realized that Watts had some real muscle in his corner. Two senior members, Bud Schuster of Pennsylvania and Jerry Lewis of California, were supporting Watts' candidacy. Schuster and Lewis, it just so happened, were also two of the members who tried to dissuade me and the rest of the Gang of Seven from looking too deeply into the House bank scandal in 1991. Watts beat me fair and square. Interestingly, one of the members to vote for Watts in that leadership election was a new representative from Wisconsin who had just been elected but not yet taken his seat, a 28-year-old named Paul Ryan. He comes up later in the story. By the time I made my second run at leadership, becoming House Majority Leader in 2006 and then Minority Leader in 2007 after the Democrats took over, I had learned a fair amount both from my years serving under Newt and in the intervening time since. I knew, for instance, that it was better to have talented members with a rabble-rousing streak working with you rather than against you. Put another way, it was better to have them inside the tent pissing out than outside pissing in. And I knew I had a great place to install these sorts of people. Those who had true leadership potential was in the position of conference chair. I knew from personal experience that serving as conference chair was a great way to understand how things really worked behind the curtain of leadership. There was a tendency, especially among the more firebrand rank-and-file members, to think the leadership folks were always up to something, plotting behind closed doors. Bringing the skeptics in showed them there really wasn't anything nefarious going on, that we were just trying to keep the team together. In the latter 2000s, much of the criticism from the Republican right flank came from the Republican Study Committee, the RSC. There was no Freedom Caucus then. It later grew out of a more extreme right wing of the RSC. But these guys were the self-styled true conservative members and were convinced that leadership was always trying to drag the party too far to the middle. The post of RSC chairman, while not an official leadership position, usually went to people who were trusted to speak for this faction. Some of the guys elevated to that role showed real political promise. I tried to spot that and help them along. One such talent was Jeb Henschling from Texas, who went on to become conference chair and then a very effective chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. Another was a very serious, passionate Indiana congressman named Mike Pence. When he first came to Congress, Pence was a fire eater, or at least well on his way to becoming one. He came from the world of talk radio, where he hadn't been afraid to court controversy. As soon as he came to the House, he'd identified strongly with the RSC, serving as its chairman from 2005 to 2007. We'd clashed over policy before, like when Pence had come out against No Child Left Behind in 2001. We also clashed over leadership. Pence had run against me for minority leader in 2005. But still, I preferred to have him pissing inside the tent than outside it. Pence was a good member, but he needed an outlet for his energy. I tried to guide him toward being more measured in his approach to governing, to show him that not every single action he may not have fully approved of needed his own scathing press release, or that sometimes you have to pick your battles. Over time, and certainly by the time he became conference chair in 2009, he had developed into a calm, collected, unflappable professional, a skill set he used to great effect as Vice President of the United States. Maybe the most important aspect of House leadership is the daily management meeting that takes place every morning around 9 or 9:30. Before that, the members in leadership all huddle with their senior staff. But when the members gather for their meeting, the real business gets done. The speaker, the leader, the whip, the conference chair are the main attendees, with other members coming in and out. Members can bring a staffer or two, and sometimes the meeting room, usually somewhere in the speaker's suite, gets crowded. I tried to run those meetings like a conversation. With Newt, it was all over the place. When I was majority leader under Speaker Dennis Hastert for about a year, it was more of a lecture. Hastert had already decided what we're going to do and was issuing orders. Well, that just wasn't my style. Hastert wasn't a particularly charismatic speaker, but he did have the presence of a coach. He'd been a high school wrestling coach for years, and years later, it was allegations of abuse of students stemming from that time that eventually sent him to prison. I was about to walk into a fundraiser at a lovely home in Pennsylvania when the news broke, and I was stunned. Then I ran into someone I'd known from the Hill who had worked for Hastert, and obviously he had just heard it too. He was as ashen-faced as I've ever seen a living person look. Looking back on it, the time I spent in the leadership under Hastert was also the scene of another strange episode. Sometime in the spring of 2006, not long after I made majority leader, someone came to me and asked me about Representative Mark Foley of Florida and kids in the House PAGE program, suggesting there was a problem. Well, that was news to me. So I did what I thought was the right thing and went straight to Hastert and told him what had been shared with me and left it with him. He seemed interested at the time, but obviously didn't do anything about it because the story broke out of nowhere in late September that Foley had behaved inappropriately with young male pages. In fact, I was in a meeting with Hastert when he excused himself to take a call, came back, and told me it was about to break. Well, I was livid. He had had a chance to address it internally and clearly had not done so. Now the Democrats had a scandal to hang around our necks before the 2006 midterms, which ended up bringing the Democrats back into power. But before that, we had to go through a whole ethics investigation. It was a mess. That was just one incident. But in general, I knew that when I became Speaker, I didn't want to run the House like the last Republican to hold that post. I wanted the back and forth. I wanted honest feedback, and I wanted to know what people were thinking. It was a way for everyone to touch gloves so that everybody on the leadership team knew what everyone else was doing, and that no one was running into each other or doing things that would somehow set us up for internal conflict. Also, it was a way to work together to avoid trouble. As the speaker, I would set the agenda, and I'd try to keep it to the main two or three things that we needed to discuss. I tried to build consensus, making sure everybody felt comfortable as we decided on a course of action. There were very rare instances when I had to cut off discussion and say, "No, sorry, but we're doing it this way." That must have happened fewer than 5 times in the 5 years I was speaker. Consensus is always the much better way to go. Sharing information honestly and openly was the best way to make sure nobody got blindsided. But the responsibility of the leadership, especially the speaker, isn't just to deal with other leaders. You have a responsibility to every single member of your conference. They were the ones who put you in the speaker's chair in the first place, and you have to forgive the ones who didn't vote for you. You owe your time and attention to everyone, from the most senior committee chairman down to the newest freshman. Arguably, the more time a good leader spends with freshman members, the better. The early years can set the tone for someone's entire congressional career. They get themselves elected, sure, but somewhere along the line, they've got to learn how to become members of Congress, especially when there's a big new class like there was in 1994 or 2010. Most of the Tea Party class of 2010 were just good, solid Republicans. It's just that a lot of them hadn't served in office before. The leadership offices tried to provide as much help as we could to help new members find the right staff, get on the right committees, and generally find their way around. Some of them figured it out, and some, well, you can't save all of them. Cultivating these individual members can eventually, if enough of them get on board, lead to the creation of a cohesive team out of 200 and some scrappy, lazy, smart, dumb, kind, nasty, opinionated, boring people all thrown together in Washington to represent millions of their fellow Americans. I used to see being leader as being more than whatever title you held, minority leader, even speaker. You're not just a figurehead. You're a principal. You're a dean of students. You're somewhere between a father and an older brother figure. There are all kinds of roles you need to play in order to keep your team together. There were times when I had to bring certain members into my office, younger ones usually, and let them know I'd got wind of them doing something they shouldn't. "Come on, boys," I'd have to tell them. "You're just cruising for a bruising." Keeping everyone under control not only protects the members themselves, but it protects the institution. A member of Congress behaving badly makes the whole House look bad and can derail whatever legislative priorities you're trying to get done to actually do something for the people who elected you. Nobody has time for bullshit like that. Speaking of bullshit, I learned early on that there's a high tolerance for that on Capitol Hill, particularly in meetings. Some days it just seemed like you were slow-motion drowning in a never-ending stream of meetings. And there are a lot of people who show up for a lot of meetings where they have lots of conversations and then nothing happens. Nobody wants to step up and make a plan. I figured out pretty quickly in the absence of any other plan, your plan becomes the plan. After that, I made sure to never walk into a meeting without a plan. If you're going to spend all this time talking about some problem or other, we better be prepared to pick, or at least suggest, an option to fix it. Otherwise, what's the point? And so there were plenty of times when my plan became the plan because there weren't any other ones. This comes in handy when you're dealing in negotiations at the highest levels. Something I kept having to remember over the years as I figured out how things really worked in the smoke-filled rooms of Washington and beyond. 4. Jerry, Jerry, and Me. Morningside Golf Club of Southern California, mid-1990s, I was standing on a beautiful green. Can't recall which one, but it doesn't really matter. It's a beautiful course no matter where you look. There are plenty of palms and other majestic trees all over the place, and majestic mountains surrounding you with more blue mountains beyond. It's just gorgeous. But at the moment, I don't give a shit about any of that. "Sorry, Jack." Nicholas, the course designer and my pal. Right now, I'm doubled over laughing my head off like a fool while a former president of the United States is stomping up and down, throwing the dirtiest word in the English language around in every direction. His face is crimson. He's mad as hell, angrier than I'd ever seen him. But even in that unguarded moment, he was one of the finest men I ever had the privilege to know. Another scene, southwestern Ohio, mid-1960s. The grass is just as green and perfectly cut as the grass at Morningside. But it's a different kind of grass. And this time, there are big white lines drawn across every 10 yards. Oh, and there are a couple thousand people on either side of me screaming their heads off, because some of them love me and some of them hate me. It's not even me they love or hate. It's just the colors and the logo and the damn uniform I have on. And lined up across from me are some of the biggest, ugliest bastards I've ever seen, waiting to stomp my head into the ground just for fun. Up there on the scoreboard next to my team's name, there's a big fat goose egg. And as for the other guys, well, let's just say they're already well into the dozens. But over on the sidelines, there's a guy wearing my team jacket, arms folded across his chest, staring right at me with hard eyes. He expects the absolute best from me, no matter how beat up I feel or how bad things look. I know if I screw this up, he's going to rip me a new one later. But even then, even though he scares the living hell out of me, he's one of the finest men I've ever had the privilege to know. If you'll permit me, I want to take a break from the weird and wild tales of Washington to tell you about a couple of genuine American heroes. Maybe it's no coincidence that they both hailed from the middle of America or that they played the same sport. It surely is a coincidence that their names both are Jerry, although one is spelled with a G. Both of them were great leaders of men. Well, one led women and children, too. One had a few more followers than the other. They both found their way to glory in very different ways, even if they had to put up with a lot of crap along the way. And I was lucky enough to learn from both. There are a number of people who helped raise me up in my life. Deb still does to this day, and so do Lindsay and Tricia. Of course, there were my parents and my brothers and sisters and friends I've had for decades. But two guys in particular loom large in my life as inspirations and examples for the leadership I carried with me all the way to the Speaker's office. Frankly, I think we'd all be better off as a country if we focused more on people like Jerry Faust and Jerry Ford, two legends in their respective fields. But more than that, two decent men who had a lasting impact on me and a lot of other people. I've had to deal with a lot of crazy shit, more than I ever thought I'd signed up for. When it really got bad, I'd pray, and then probably, with a little nudge from the man upstairs, I'd remember the example of these two guys. Knowing them and learning from them gave me a grounding that helped me get through a lot of different messes. The story begins in a darkened classroom, where the only light came from a flickering screen at the front of the room. There was a short film about a brand new local high school, Archbishop Muller, that had only opened a few years earlier and was looking to recruit kids to join its newest class. Once the movie part was over, they turned the lights back on, and I blinked a bit as my eyes got adjusted, as did the rest of my fellow Saints Peter and Paul junior high school eighth graders. This was already a banner day at the school, and it was only going to get better. A big, tall guy with broad shoulders and a crew cut strode with heavy footsteps around the back of the room, up to the front, and turned around and asked if we had any questions. He had introduced himself at the beginning of the session, but to most of us, he needed no introduction. This was Jerry Faust, Muller's head football coach, here to talk to us junior high guys in person. This beat the hell out of algebra class any day. Faust was already a football legend in our part of Ohio. His father had coached at Chaminade High School in Dayton, just one county over. Jerry played under him there before going on to be a star quarterback at the University of Dayton. He graduated in 1958 and 4 years later signed on to be the first head coach at Muller, which had opened in 1960. There, he became one of the most successful high school coaches in the country. At Muller, he put up a total record of 178 wins, 23 losses, with 7 unbeaten seasons. He later went on to be the head coach at Notre Dame, where his record wasn't as good, but at Muller, his legacy was, and still is, secure. All of the Catholic high schools in that part of the Cincinnati area drew from different parishes. Before Muller was built, the Catholic kids from the area would have gone to either Purcell High or Roger Bacon High. I would have ended up going to one of those myself. But when Jerry Fouth came to coach at Muller, that changed the game. Every elementary and middle school kid playing football wanted to make it to the big leagues and play for this real live local hero. I've been playing football since I was a little kid, mostly defense, but I learned to become a pretty good long snapper too. Before Faust had even begun his presentation, I was already sold. So I don't remember paying that close of attention when he talked about everything the school had to offer, the academics, the brand new facilities, and all of that. I'm sure it was nice, but come on, that's not what I gave a hoot about. He mentioned something about becoming men of Muller. It was an all-boys high school, but I wasn't listening that closely. I just couldn't wait to lace up my cleats and show Coach Faust what I could do. Imagine how it felt then, after Faust finished his talk and started to walk down the rows of desks, when he stopped at mine and put his hand on my shoulder. His big, broad hand, a quarterback's hand, all right, and just rested there for a second. I froze. He looked me right in the eye, man to man, and said, "I sure hope you're going to come. We're looking forward to having you on the team." I'd never met Faust, definitely had never spoken to him. Why he decided to stop at my desk, I still have no idea. Maybe I just looked like a beefy kid who probably played football. But however it happened, it was the highlight of my life up to that point. I was pumped up and ready to hit the Muller field right then and there. It was only later that I realized how much I would learn from Jerry Faust that had nothing to do with football, and what becoming a man of Muller really meant. Playing for Coach Faust was exactly the kind of experience that would bring a group of guys together. At first, we were united in fear. Faust was tough. His dad had been even tougher. He used to carry around a leather strap to whack his players, his own son included, when they screwed up. That wasn't Jerry Faust style. He got mad, sure, but I never once heard him use a four-letter word. He sure knew how to make himself understood, though. He'd get right in your face, grab hold of your face mask, and shake your head when he really wanted to get a point across. But you didn't have to play for him long to realize that he was just as fair as he was tough. He knew how to inspire us and motivate us to be the best we could be. When you did something right, he let you know it. When you screwed up, he let you know it too. One practice, I got a great block on Jerry Mauch, another Jerry I know, a senior linebacker whose family owned the jewelry store across the street from Andy's Cafe. He and I got along fine, and our families were friends, but I was lined up against Jerry, and I had my own job to do. Coach Faust saw my block and came over to us after the whistle blew. "Nice work, Boehner," he said, and I felt like I was on cloud nine. Then he turned to Jerry. "Get off my field." Poor Jerry had to go run laps for letting a reserve guy like me get the best of him. But once he got back on the line for the rest of the practice, Jerry made sure to lay my ass out every chance he got. 2 years later, I ended up on the other end of that stick. I was a senior pulling guard, and one practice was lined up against a sophomore defensive end who I guess hadn't hit his growth spurt yet. He was a small guy. I felt bad for him. When I went to block him, I'd hold him at arm's length to take it easy on him. Faust saw me, blew the whistle, came right over and ripped me a new one. He got right in my face and reminded me that I had one job to do, and that was to block, period. If I wouldn't take it easy on the other guy in the game, I'm damn sure shouldn't do it in practice. Then he stepped back and hollered, "I want to run that play again." And turning right straight toward me, he said, "And Boehner, you're going to block that guy." The next play, I floored that poor little sophomore flat on his back. "Now that's more like it," Coach said. Faust's sense of humor would pop up in the most unexpected places. One day my sophomore year, when I was walking down the hall on my way to class, and from somewhere behind me, I heard this voice, "Hey, Boehner." I turned around, hopefully thinking maybe he was going to tell me that I was getting called up to play in that week's game. "Nope." "Boehner," he asked, "why do you have a wallet in each back pocket?" Well, I didn't have a clue what he meant. I hadn't put one wallet in my back pocket, let alone in both. Then it dawned on me Coach Faust was making fun of me for having a big butt. Great. He walked away chuckling down the hall. Nowadays, I guess people would make some big deal about body shaming, but I just laughed it off, although I clearly never forgot it. From that day forward, I've never carried a wallet in my back pocket. Not once. A couple of jokes thrown your way were just part of the deal. Nothing could make me disloyal to Jerry Faust. When my junior year came along and I was looking at a spot on the varsity football team, I ended up having to make a tough choice. I played basketball my first 2 years at Muller, and my junior season was about to start. A lot of the guys on the football team played other sports as conditioning. Jerry Van ran track and was one of the best runners in the school. I had a lot of fun playing basketball, and our coach, Jerry Durger, was a fine man. Yet, another great Jerry in my life. It's a common name in our part of the world. Okay, Durger coached high school basketball well into his 80s, and his famous Durger defense was known to generations of Cincinnati area athletes. One day I was walking down a hallway to class, I heard what sounded like an argument around the corner. As I got a little closer, I realized it was Durger and Faust arguing back and forth about some kid. Uh-oh, I thought. I'd hate to be in that poor sucker's tennis shoes. Well, I pulled up short when I heard them mention my name. Faust wanted me off the basketball team so I could spend more time in the weight room. Muller was one of the first high school football programs in the country to have a weight training program. And boy, it was state-of-the-art. One of the assistant coaches ran it out of his basement. Faust thought I could really make a difference on the varsity football team if I focused on that and got my strength up. But Durger was telling Faust to back off. He wanted to keep me on the basketball team. For me, it was not a hard decision to make. I was closer to Faust and trusted his judgment. So I quit basketball that year and hit the weight room. I was going to stick with football for the next 2 years. And my 2 years playing varsity for Jerry Faust were two of the most meaningful years of my young life. That's not to say I was some football superstar. Far from it. I wasn't even guaranteed to make the varsity team as a junior. We all had to try out again, and Faust made it clear that you wouldn't make varsity unless you were willing to put in the work. He had no time for slackers. For me, that meant sweating it out in the weight room when I would rather have been playing basketball. But I made the varsity team, and that made it all worth it. Being a starter was a totally different ballgame, literally. Everything changes when you're out there in the middle of the field and the stands are full of your family and friends all looking down at you, hoping you don't screw up. I just tried to do the best I could, which, in sports, politics, and pretty much everything else, is easier said than done. I played linebacker or pulling guard most of the time, but somehow my long snapper skills from back in junior high had stuck with me, so I played that position too. That meant I was on the field a fair amount, which meant more chances to screw things up. In one game against Newport Catholic, we were set up to punt and I was in position, ready to snap the ball to the kicker. As we lined up at the line of scrimmage, I had noticed the linebacker across from me was a giant. That was bad enough. But as I got over the ball, in the few seconds before the play was called, I made the mistake of looking into this guy's face. Even through the face mask, I could tell he was just about the ugliest son of a bitch I'd ever seen in my young life, and he was looking right at me. Right before the snap was called, and I'll never forget this sound as long as I live, he looked at me and growled. He let out this low, guttural sound that basically said, "I'm going to eat you alive." Well, that scared the living hell out of me, and I let off a bad snap that sent the ball flying over the kicker's head. After that, my fear of the ugly linebacker was replaced by a much more immediate fear, getting reamed out by Coach Faust for flubbing the snap. There was one time when I decided I just couldn't face Faust's temper at all. It was my junior year. We'd just been handed a pretty bad loss by Princeton High School in Cincinnati. We didn't lose often during my 2 years on the varsity, but when we did, we knew there was going to be hell to pay at the team meeting the next morning. When I woke up that Saturday morning, I decided I just wasn't going. Wasn't even getting out of bed. After the gut-wrenching loss the night before, I just couldn't take reliving it with Coach, with an extra helping of anger thrown in at the practice afterward, so I stayed under the covers. My mother was not having it. She came into the room with all the bunk beds I shared with my brothers, all empty except for me, firmly planted in mine. "Get out of that bed, John," she said. "You made a commitment to that team, and you better be there with them when they take the heat." I didn't care. If it meant I had to quit, fine. I was not going to face Coach Faust that morning. Then the phone rang out in the hall. Mom went to answer it. "Yes, he's here," I heard her say. Then there was a pause. "Don't worry, he's coming. He's just running a little late, but he'll be there." She almost had to drag me out of bed, but sure enough, I made it. Coach made me run extra laps for being late, so in the end, I missed the worst parts of the rehashing of Friday night's game after all. But that was the last time I ever thought about quitting. Although, something happened my senior year that did make me wonder if my high school football career would end early. Our arch rival was Roger Bacon High School, and we hated those guys. That year, we knew the game against them was going to be a bruiser. Their coach, Bron Vasevich, had put together a top-notch team, and our work was cut out for us. We had an intense practice schedule set up for the whole week leading up to Friday's game. On Monday, Coach Faust showed up with a cooler full of some special kind of drink. It was supposed to help give us energy, he said. It wasn't on the market yet. It was some sort of magic formula that had been cooked up at the University of Florida. He called it Gatorade. Nobody in the team had ever heard of it before, and I still don't know how he got a hold of it. But for that week, we fueled up on Gatorade, hoping we'd be able to practice that much harder and really hand it to Roger Bacon. Friday came. We were playing part of a doubleheader matchup of Catholic high schools held at Xavier University Stadium. Playing in a college stadium was a huge deal. In the opening game that afternoon, LaSalle beat McNicholas. Muller versus Roger Bacon was the marquee bout. In the end, the secret Florida formula didn't help us much. We lost 45-0, still the worst defeat in Muller history, and I ended up getting carried off the field. I'd gone for a block, and the next thing I knew, I was on my back and couldn't move. On the sidelines, the team doctor, who was an osteopath and didn't seem to always have his shit together, poked around and said everything seemed fine. My back spasms disagreed with him. I'd had some back issues before, going back to the age of 15, when I'd wrenched something lifting a crate of pickles at Andy's Cafe. I got checked out at a hospital where they found no permanent damage, but my back really has never been the same since. I returned to practice a few days later, and I played through the rest of the season, even when my back flared up. The way I saw it, it was my final season. I'd been with the team all 4 years, and there was no way I was going to miss the last couple of games because of a backache. Besides, by that point, I knew that I probably wasn't going to make it as a football player in college. But I'd been playing most of my life, and I wanted to enjoy the game as much as I could before I hung up my cleats for good. It was a good thing that I hadn't concentrated only on football in school. There were actual classes I had to attend, and after all, I had to do something in the off-season, right? But in academics, like athletics, I wasn't the worst, but I sure wasn't the best either. I never got a D or F in my life, but I didn't get many A's or B's either. Jerry Faust was my teacher as well as my coach. He taught typing. A bunch of us signed up because we figured Coach liked us and we'd have an easy time passing the class. We thought we were pretty slick, as so many teenagers do. We should have known that he would be just as demanding in the classroom as he was on the field. He made us attack those typewriters like they were Roger Bacon linemen. He worked our fingers sore just as he worked our legs sore in practice. Somehow I passed, but I'm still not very good at typing. Of course, faith was a big part of what brought the Muller community together. Praying and going to Mass had been a big part of my life for as long as I could remember. My family went to Saints Peter and Paul Church for Mass together every Sunday. In grade school, we had Mass every day before school started. At Muller, which was run by the Marianist priest and brothers, it was only once a week. But if you were on Jerry Faust's football team, you never forgot who was really in charge. We said Hail Marys before and after every practice. On game day Fridays, we said more prayers than I thought anyone knew. We prayed that morning, we prayed together at lunch, and in the afternoon there was a special Mass before we got ready for the game. If it was an away game, we prayed on the bus. We prayed on the sidelines before the game. We prayed at halftime. We prayed after the game, whether we won or lost. I said more Hail Marys in high school than at any other point in my life, and I still say some every day. Remembering that God has a plan, that it was bigger than you and bigger than a football game, was important. Years later, I would remind myself that God had a plan. It was bigger than any House bill or a blown-up White House negotiation. And it definitely helped to keep that 45-0 loss in perspective. Going to Mueller also showed me there was a much bigger world out there than the little corner of Reading, Ohio, where I grew up. Most of my life up until then had been spent between my parents' house, my grandparents' house, Andy's Cafe, church, and small parish schools where I knew almost everybody. At Mueller, I met a whole bunch of different kinds of people from all over. Some kids dressed to the nines every day. And I realized for the first time that although my family wasn't poor by any means, we didn't have nearly as much money as a lot of folks in our area. But I also learned how little that really mattered. What mattered was how hard you worked and how you treated everybody. It was these kinds of lessons that helped set me straight before going out into the wider world, and some of the most important ones I learned from Jerry Fast. He taught me to never quit, that the absolute only way to get what you want is by putting in the work day after day. The simple phrase, never give up, might sound corny, but I'll tell you, when you're in a giant college stadium getting blasted by your rival school in front of everyone you know, and that scoreboard is ticking up to 45-0, it's pretty tempting to want to give up. And if you hurt your back during that mess of a game, who in their right mind would go back? Why not sit the rest of the season out? Coach wouldn't have it. It was that simple. And most of us would do anything we could not to disappoint Coach Faust. More than a coach, he was a teacher, a mentor, a father figure to everyone who ever played for him. He did more than teach us how to run this play or that one and yell at us when we screwed up. He taught us what it meant to be men of Mueller, to know what was required of us to become men and become leaders, and to do the right thing no matter what. Coach Faust loved coaching at Mueller. He once said he'd only leave the job under one circumstance, if he was ever asked to become the head coach at his beloved University of Notre Dame. As it turned out, he was asked to do just that. It was unusual, to say the least, for any college program to hire a head coach from a high school team who had no experience on the collegiate level. In most cases, a coach like Jerry Faust would be brought in at a secondary post, like an offensive coordinator. And it was unheard of for a program like Notre Dame to take a gamble like this. Coach Faust had to have felt the risk, too. He would be giving up his incredible record at the high school level to take a shot at one of the most watched football programs in the country. What if he blew it? But the idea of walking in the same footsteps as legends like Newt Rockne was irresistible to him. So he headed off to South Bend to take the field with the Fighting Irish for the 1981 season. Unfortunately, his record at Notre Dame was nowhere close to what it was at Mueller. Still, Faust treated every day spent there as an honor and left a mark of good sportsmanship and integrity on every player he met. And he had a view of life that I try to copy during all my time in Congress. No matter the setbacks, he felt honored and lucky that the good Lord had given him a chance at this dream. After all, most people don't even make it that far, and he knew he gave it his all. When he stepped down in 1985, he said, "I only had 26 miserable days at Notre Dame. That's when we lost. Other than that, I was the happiest guy in the world." And I knew what he meant. So those 26 game days were rough. But all the practices, all the time spent getting to know and work with fine young men on a campus where the Catholic faith runs strong, those days were good for his soul. And anyone who played for him will tell you that learning from him was good for theirs, too. There was another guy I came to know much later who also knew a thing or two about what was good for the soul. He stepped in to clear away one of the biggest shitstorms this country has ever seen, and in doing so, helped to heal the soul of our nation. He'd never let anyone say that kind of thing about him when he was alive, because that's just how modest he was. But now that he's dead, I'll say it as loud as I want, and I don't care who hears it. This was President Gerald R. Jerry Ford. When I first met him, I thought I was being set up for a presidential-sized smack on the wrist. At the time, I was a freshman congressman who liked to spend time throwing bombs at his party's leadership. So then I got invited by the leader of my party to go out and play golf with one of the greatest institutionalists the House had ever known. It was 1992 when Bob Michael of Illinois, the leader of the Republicans in Congress, asked me to come to the Jerry Ford Invitational, a pro-am golf tournament the former President Ford held in Vail, Colorado, every August since he left politics in 1977. I didn't know what Michael was up to. There had to be some sort of catch. Clearly, I was in trouble for something. I had spent my first term making a few friends and a lot of enemies, kicking over rocks like the House Bank and the House Post Office that had been enriching members of Congress by costing the taxpayers dearly. Needless to say, this upset the leadership of both parties. Democrat Speaker Tom Foley and Michael was the top Republican, and because I was in Michael's party, it was his job to try to deal with me. To be frank, that was a pain in the ass. But somehow, I still kept up a good personal relationship with Bob and his chief of staff, Billy Pitts, always making sure to give them a heads up when I was up to something with my young hotshot buddies. After all, it doesn't cost anything to be nice. Bob was a golfer himself, and he liked that I was. That was something we had in common, at least. He had been in Congress since 1957 and served alongside Gerald Ford in the House for many years. Even though he went on to serve in higher office, Ford's true love in politics was the House of Representatives. He knew the institution inside out. As we got to become closer friends later, I learned how deep that love went. Maybe Bob Michael thought it would be good for this hot-headed freshman to meet the grand old institutionalist. So he asked me to come out to the tournament after we finished nominating President George Herbert Walker Bush to run for re-election at the Republican National Convention in Houston. And, of course, I accepted. That's when I first met Jerry Ford. President Gerald Ford is not a name that most people think of these days when considering great Republican presidents. That's not really his fault. Ford's problem was that he was surrounded by two men who were both very prominent for different reasons, Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. He also narrowly lost his own election to the presidency to Jimmy Carter in 1976. But none of that changes the fact that Ford was an important leader in the 20th century. He took over after Nixon resigned in disgrace, and his integrity and decency were essential to restoring public trust in public officials. Prior to his time in the White House, he was a leader in the U.S. Congress and had worked to reform the House in his own day. There were very few people in the world who counted Ford as an enemy. Even Carter, his one-time bitter political rival, eulogized him when he died. I had the great privilege of calling Jerry Ford a friend. Over the years, I had glimpses of the real Jerry Ford in the sport that truly shows people who they are: golf. After Ford died, a local newspaper said his drive was as straight as his character and true as his word. Yeah, right. As a man, Ford was certainly always straight and true, but the same could not always be said for his swing. Though he got a bad rap over the years as some kind of klutz, as president, he once fell down a flight of steps. He was a fine athlete, a former football star at the University of Michigan. But golf was a different matter. He loved the sport mostly as a reason to hang around with his friends and have a good time. But he was not a natural golfer. When he was vice president, he once sent a golf ball flying so far off target that it hit a bystander in the head, sending the guy to the hospital. On the same day, another ball pounded an unsuspecting golf cart that was carrying a policeman. Golf legend Arnold Palmer used to joke that Ford's kamikaze golf balls just barely missed him on more than one occasion. The famed comedian Bob Hope, an old friend and golfing partner of the president, used to say, "It's not hard to find Jerry Ford on the golf course. Just follow the wounded." There was a great group of current and former members of Congress, lobbyists, professional golfers, and other celebrities, most of whom I barely knew, who showed up for these Jerry Ford invitationals, and everybody had a hell of a time. Days on the golf course were followed by nights with good food and good wine. And you can still smoke pretty much everywhere. In fact, I became especially good friends with a former Ford military aide who had gone on to work for U.S. Tobacco. Given my long-term acquaintance with their product, I figured he'd be a good guy to know. I had so much fun on my first visit that I made a point to come back every year. I once played in a foursome with country music star Vince Gill, who, in case you wondered how clueless about pop culture I was, and still am, I had never heard of, let alone met. He was mobbed on the golf course, Everybody wanted his autograph. They hardly seemed to care about Ford, the man who rescued the country after Watergate. It says something a little disturbing about the country, especially our education system, when people recognize a singer more than a president. But Ford being Ford, he took it all in stride. The last year of the tournament was held in 1996. Ford wanted to make that one special. And for me, it truly was. That year, I had brought along one of my longtime friends from my hometown, Al Buzmeyer. It seemed like the whole town of Vail had turned out for the last ever Jerry Ford Invitational. There were huge ads taken out in the local paper telling everyone to come out to the Vail Golf Club. And the people showed up in a big way. There were crowds all over the course. Ford was in demand everywhere. So it was totally understandable that he didn't have time for everyone. Yet, somehow, he seemed to. In the middle of the circus, on the first day, Buzz and I ended up in the same foursome with President Ford. Ford had never met Buzz, who was just a regular guy from Ohio, and was in awe of all the big-name celebrities all around. About halfway through the course, out of nowhere, Ford said, "Hey, Buzz, come over here and read this putt for me." And without batting an eye, up stepped Buzz. He gave Ford his 2 cents, and the former president sank the putt. After that, Buzz ended up basically being Ford's caddy for the next 3.5 days. Ford would barely take a swing, especially not a putt, without getting Buzz's advice. Buzz, of course, was eating all this up. A former president of the United States needed his advice to play golf on a world-class course. I get a little choked up at the idea of me and my buddy being lucky enough to be yucking it up with a former president who treated us like we've been friends for years.